I've been here a few times now, and if you guys can't hear me, you guys come up if you want. But first time I was here, this is kind of some blank feedback here. The first time I was, I can hear myself very well. Okay, so first time I was here. I talked about more motor movement, motor control, and people who have diseases, and how we treat people who have those problems, and the neuroscience behind that. Second time I was here, I was talking about more in terms of rehabilitation of people who have traumatic experiences, such as fear. They have these car accidents and big trauma, and then after that, they are not able to cope with fear. So this time we're kind of bringing a little bit, one more step up, right? So motor movements, very basic behaviors, fear learning, fear extinction, a little more behavioral level, trying to understand circuits that's involved. And this time it's a little bit more even global level of looking at even more complex behaviors. And what I like to call as social cognition. So I will spend the better part of the first half or so of the lecture talking about what that actually means. So for you who are medical students, for example, may not be as familiar with the paradigms that psychologists mostly use to study social dynamics. But I think you guys will find it very interesting, because I find that Japan is actually very interesting social dynamics in terms of groups, individuals, how they fit within the groups, and then also how the groups interact. So hopefully you guys can get something out of a study of that as well. So let's get started. So what I'm going to talk about mostly today is about some of the mechanisms, but also just the description of social influence. So by social influence, I mean dynamics between individuals and individual within groups that affects how we behave, the actions we take, and the opinions we take. For example, if you're watching TV every day, right, you notice you're getting a lot of information from television, right? You're getting things such as, oh, this product is great, you know, Coca-Cola is delicious, especially after meals, et cetera, et cetera. After a while, that kind of information gets into your head, and this is why I like to call it implicit learning. You're actually implicitly learning information that's just given to you without you particularly having to think about it. Because look, when you're watching the TV, you're really thinking about, oh, I wonder what that other character is going to do next in the next part of the show. You're not thinking, oh, this Coke would be great right now. What you're really happening is that implicitly in the background, you're giving a lot of information that's actually changing your preferences later. So one basic experiment that people have done is that actually they've shown people while they're doing a task. So they're doing a task in which they're saying, oh, this is correct or this is incorrect, right? So completely unrelated task. But during this task, they actually flash pictures of either Coca-Cola or Pepsi very briefly so that you can't actually detect, right? So it's like, you know, milliseconds so that your eyes cannot even detect. For example, afterwards, they get asked whether you saw anything during your task. And people actually say, no, I can't tell. They can't even tell whether they saw Coke versus Pepsi, right? But if it's the case that the Coke trials came up when the person got the thing right, the task that they were doing, they gave a correct answer, they actually go in later on in a second day or maybe hours later test, and they prefer Coke over Pepsi, right, statistically. So in other words, something is happening even when in a completely unrelated task that's actually influencing how you think about different things, such as products, people, like people you meet who look a certain way. Very unconsciously, you're processing information about stereotypes, such as, oh, what this person looks like, what kind of likely family background. You know, like this guy is probably not from Japan. He's probably from Asia somewhere. Is he from China or is he from Taiwan? You know, you're processing that information very quickly, unknown to yourself, actually. Okay, so that's a basic introduction. So one of the some of the factors that influence how we are affected by social influence are what I'm giving you here. This is from a famous social psychology psychologist Herbert Kelman from Harvard back in the days in the 50s, 60s, etc. So what he identified was a few categories in which these kinds of behaviors are affected kind of noticeably. One is called compliance. So, oh, by the way, so this lecture, I will try to speak slowly, a little bit more kind of deliberate than before in the last two, because you know, I feel like sometimes the material is difficult, so I will, so stop me whenever you feel like it's going too fast, but I also will just try to, you know, make sure you guys try to understand everything. Okay, so the first category is compliance. So what compliance means is that you agree with somebody due to some sort of pressure, even though you yourself may not believe what you think, right? So what they think. So this is the classic, with this is social pressure. So in school, you know, say if 90% of the people in the class is, you know, in America, you know, they're liberal or conservative, for example, like Democrats or Republicans. If everybody's expressing the same opinion, like, for example, the Republican opinion, for example, even if somebody privately disagrees, they won't say it in an opinion poll. Like, they give you a poll, and then they find statistically significant that these people are actually changing their opinion, right, as opposed to, like, before the class, for example. So that's called compliance. And it's very important to recognize compliance when you see it, right? Because in your everyday life, you realize a lot of times you're pressured to do something, right? Like drinking here, right? Like it's expected to drink in a drinking party, right? But if you don't want to drink, you should just not drink, right? But the thing is, there's some pressure, and that kind of leads you to do things that you may not want to do, for example, right? Okay, so another thing is called identification. This also happens a lot. So identification means that you're influenced with by someone who either you like or you respect or you admire in some way, right? So the classic example of this is like when you see ads on TV. So why is it that they have kind of famous people like, you know, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, you know, sell shoes, right? Well, first of all, if you're wearing sports shoes, like for basketball, you're probably into one of the sports, basketball or something like that, right? If you're into sports, then probably you watch a lot of sports. And if you watch a lot of sports, that means you probably like the people who are really good, like LeBron James, right, who recently won NBA titles, right? So if you really respect LeBron James, then whatever LeBron James wears is probably good, right? Like there's a reason that he got so good. So this is why there's an identification component. You don't know if that shoe is any good, actually. You know, it could be more expensive to the exact same shoes were worn by, you know, the neighbor next door who is not so great at basketball. But because you have no other way of thinking about the situation, the first thing you thought, wow, if LeBron James is wearing it, it must be good, right? Without actual facts, actual evidence. Because nobody's going to actually go and look at the shoe and figure out, you know, if it's really, really good, right, by doing market research. So that's identification. Another thing is internalization. So internalization means that it's the tendency to try to make things fit with your own opinion. So this is different from compliance, okay? So I want you guys to listen carefully. Internalization means that so somebody else publicly could have a different set of beliefs, right? For example, some people who don't agree with, you know, Prime Minister Abe, for example, on some specific issue. Now, publicly, there's that belief, but then privately, you actually want to try to fit things well. Like, for example, if your boss thinks a certain way, subconsciously, you want to kind of get in line with that. It's okay if you disagree on certain things, but you also want to try to get along as much as possible. So that's what is known as internalization. This one is tricky, right? First of all, it's harder to study because it's a very minute detail. But the other thing is that it's harder to detect because a lot of people would take that opinion of the group, for instance, and think that is it's the truth. But actually what's happening is that they actually internalize the external information to agree with their own. So the social influence is a little bit more tricky. You're not complying with someone else per se, like they're not pressuring you to do it, but you yourself is internally driven to kind of seek more of a harmonious state. And the reason is because your own value, you think is actually, so in this case, the difference is this. The difference is that you think your value is actually good. You think your value is the best, actually. So in order to make the best part of the society that it belongs in, you adapt it in such a way to make it fit. So hopefully you guys understand the difference between compliance and internalization. It's very tricky, okay?
No.
Is it?
It's hard to tell the difference between compliance and internalization.
Okay, let me say it again. I'll try to be a little bit clearer if I can. So compliance is the following. The compliance is, say you have some opinion A, right, that other people don't share, right? When you're in a group, everybody believes in opinion B, which happens to be the hantai, the exact opposite of A, for instance. In that case, there's social pressure. People around you are actually telling you, oh, this is the best. B is the best. I know B is doing this and this and this. In that case, they're trying to get you to comply with them. So that's the compliance issue. The internalization, the motive there is different, basically. I mean, the end result, I agree, is kind of similar in some ways, but the motive is a little bit different. So the motive there is from your own. In that case, you want to agree publicly and privately. In other words, you want your own opinion to be the correct opinion which is reflected in the public that you think. So that's why you actually internalize the information. You say, well, if this is believed, I should match my own. So they're actually kind of changing their own view. Whereas in compliance, they really don't want to drink. They're just forced to do it because somebody else kind of gets them to do it. As an internalization, they're actually changing their own viewpoint. Yeah. But anyway, so, I mean, that's a good question. But these things are all related, right? I mean, it's hard to, just like you were saying, it's kind of hard to separate the two. So this is kind of an arbitrary categorization, but as we'll see later on, there's a lot of different experiments to look at exactly how each contributes, and sometimes the experiment detail is actually very bimyo, very difficult to separate out. So this is the framework I want to go with. So here's my roadmap for this lecture. I have until 1:30, that's right, right? I have 1:30, I believe. 1:20. Okay, in that case, I'll move forward. Okay, so first I'm going to talk about what social influence is. I'll give you some examples of the social influence affecting us. And then lastly, I'll look at some of the neural mechanism, which is actually kind of interesting stuff because you can actually look at the biology and the neuroscience. Okay, welcome. You're just in time. Okay, so first, there's an experiment looking at social influences that suggest that it really is implicit, okay, which means it's not acting in a kind of very conscious level, okay? So here's an experiment. So this is an experiment from Ellen Langer quite a bit ago. So what they looked at was, just take the following. So you see a bunch of people who are standing in line, right? So actually, let me show you this picture first. Okay, it's called the Because experiment. I'll show you why in a second. So people are getting in line to do photocopies, okay? Now, the experiment is the following. The experiment is, can someone, the experimenter, go in and cut in line and do a photocopy ahead of someone who is in front of you. Actually, in Japan, this is a difficult experiment. In Japan, it's not usually right to cut in line. But in America, this can happen. You can get a good 40-60% chance. Basically, if someone will let you go for like an appreciative amount of time, they're going, okay, you, yeah, this is a failed trial in which you could not cut in line. But if you were able to cut in line, then you succeeded. And the measurement is how many percent of the time it works. So you do that in budget times with different people, and then you calculate how many times you were successful by saying specific things, okay? So here's the different groups, okay? So let's go down on the bottom of the page here first. In the first group, what you do is you say, excuse me, I have 5 pages. Can I use a Xerox machine? So Xerox is the copier. Usually called Xerox in America, right? So that's simple, right? You don't know this person, you just do it. The experiment is taught to do exactly the same way every time. They do the exact same kind of smileless, you know, not angry, just kind of smileless, exact same thing, you know, kind of same posture, right? The second thing is, the second thing is, they say it's almost the same thing, except at the end, they say, may I use the Xerox machine because I'm in a rush? Okay, so they give a reason. There was also actually other reasons as well. They say something like, my mom is sick, I need to do, you know, something more complicated they use also, but this one actually tends to work, actually, because I'm in a rush. Okay? Now, the third group is an interesting group, okay? Because see if you guys are catching what's going on here. In the third group, what you say is, excuse me, I have 5 pages. Can I use the Xerox machine because I have to make copies? Do you guys kind of understand what's going on? There's no real reason, right? There's actually, she's just stating exactly what she's doing. Like, there's no real additional reason. In group two, you're actually giving a reason that makes some sense. You could also even give more elaborate reasons, but that one already works. In group three, she's just stating something. It's kind of nonsense. You can even say anything you want, you know, almost, as long as it doesn't stand out, as long as it doesn't sound like it's completely out of the blue, you can actually say anything there, okay, after the because. And the question is, these three groups, what are the rates in which you can get success? Success being able to cut in line and actually do the photocopy. And then, what Alan is going to do, Alan Langer is going to do, is going to interpret it based on these groups. So actually, I'm going to go forward because, you know, make sure I have enough time. So it's called the because experiment. It's because of the following. So what happens is when the request is small, which is the 5 pages that they're doing instead of the 20 pages, it's a different story when it's 20 pages, but I'm going to skip over that detail. But when there's only 5 pages, the subjects comply 94% of the time, even when they just said, because I have to make copies. That's all you have to do. You just go up there and you say, because I have to make copies. Well, I mean, clearly, that's exactly what I'm doing. It's nonsense reason, right? There's no good reason at all. But it works, right? If you give, only the request, which means you don't give the reason, it still works 60% of the time, okay? Now, if you give a large request, which means you want to copy 20 pages, right? Then people are thinking about it differently. They're being aware of the situation. So Langer refers to this as mindfulness. That's taking you outside of implicit learning. That's taking you into explicit effects. Okay? So this is why, as I said before, this experiment, the description of the experiment, that the social influence could be working in an implicit, which means non-conscious level. Because when the request is small, 5 pages, what happens is that people ignored what you said after because. All they did was they heard because. Because means you have a reason. You have some reason and they assume it's a good reason. As long as the request is not crazy, which in this case crazy being 20 pages. As long as the request was 5 pages, people go like, dude, there must be some good reason. You know, he or she said because, as opposed to not saying anything after the request. It must be the case that there's a good reason, therefore, okay, let's the person cut in line and do the things. And so this is what I mean by implicit processes, right? There's some implicit process going on in the mind that is changing how someone is behaving based on influences that's beyond simple explicit statements, right? So the way that, by the way, that the way that they interpret this experiment, different people do it differently, but most of the time the way they interpret it is that they go into this fixed action pattern, right? So it's kind of like, well, we don't need to go in there, but kind of like animal behavior. Because what happens is that when people hear because, all of a sudden they think, okay, this is something that makes sense, let's let the person do it, as long as it's a small request. And that kind of pattern also happens in other processes, such as people think if something is expensive, it must be good. Like, that's the first thing they think first. It could or could not be good. If they're really interested in buying it, they will examine it in detail. But the first thing they think is good first. Right? Same thing with coupons, right? So in America, actually, a lot of times they hike up the prices and then they give you a coupon. But the coupon means it's a discount, so it must be cheaper. So even though they actually did this experiment where they look at the prices post-coupon, which is actually higher than the original price, and people actually have more demand for it. Because there's an implicit effect where people think coupon automatically means cheap. Right, so it's very, very interesting. So the interpretation of the experiment is that you don't even need a relevant reason, you can get any reason, and you can actually get better compliance. Okay, so in interest of time, I will continue to move forward. So this is telling about implicit processes, okay? Now, what are the actual processes that you need to be aware of and the ones that neuroscientists actually want to look at, right? There are a bunch of them, so I will highlight three or four of them, okay, for you. So the first one is reciprocity. I think we're all more or less aware of this, right? If someone gives you a gift, you want to give them a gift. And in fact, I guess in Japan, you want to give them like 10 times the gift, I guess, right? White Day, you have to give 10 times the chocolate. That's kind of the thing. Americans don't know this as well, so they have to study it, okay? So anyway, this is an experiment from Dennis Regan's lab. I think he's in Cornell. So what happens is that, Stanford. So what happened here is that they're recruiting students to do this kind of fake art appreciation experiment, right? So they give them a bunch of artworks, and then, let me see if I have a picture of it. Yeah, I'll have a picture for you later. They give them a bunch of artworks, and they just kind of rate number numerically how nice this artwork is, right? They have like two sessions of this, right? But the key thing is the following. As they're doing this artwork, they have artwork rating, they have someone else who's doing the same thing. That someone else is actually an experimenter. Okay, his name is Joe. Okay? So what happens is in between the trials, in between the first set of ratings and second ratings, Joe either leaves and comes back, nothing. Okay? Some of them, they actually come back with just say hi, you know, like just basic social hello recognition. But in some other trials, what they do is that he goes away and he comes back with two Cokes, Coca-Cola. And he gives one of the Cokes to the subject and say, oh, I happen to be getting a Coke. You know, you look thirsty, here's a Coke. No reason. Try to keep the interaction as short as possible so that you're not contaminating. You're not like getting them to have too much kind of likability. You know, it's literally just someone giving you a Coke. All right, so they try to control for that. And there's another group, actually, I'm not going to go into as much detail on that, but there's another group where someone else gives that person a Coke. So someone who's not Joe, and later on he's going to be asked to rate Joe. Okay, so irrelevant person, has nothing to do with anything. Now, after the rating, set of ratings, Joe comes by and he's selling raffle tickets, right? This is kind of, you know, 20 years back. That's why the raffle tickets are only 25 cents. But so he's selling raffle tickets, right? And if he sells the most of, I guess, people in his company, he gets $50, which is quite a bit for him, right? And the winner of the raffle actually gets an American car, basically. It's called Corvette, right? And then what he asks is, he asks the subject, well, you know, it would be really great if you could buy a raffle ticket. Write down how many raffle tickets you want. And then he goes away. The reason they do that is because they want the verbal processes influencing what's going on. They actually literally just want the rating of how much he wants. Right? And then after the whole experiment, the subject, you know, the person who was asked to do the ratings of the paintings, is actually going to also rate this person, Joe. The Joe that either just went away and came back, did nothing, he's like, okay, whatever. The Joe that just sat there because someone else gave him the Coke, and he just went away and came back, did nothing. Or the Joe that went back and gave you a Coke. Okay? So, as you would probably expect, reciprocity is happening here, right? So here's the data, right? So maybe a little bit complicated, but first let's concentrate on the middle panel, okay? So this middle panel here. So the upper one is just a illustration of what this experiment looks like. Right? You give them a Coke, right? So forget about the bottom five for now. There's some intricacy there, but on the top one. Top one are the three groups I mentioned, right? Favor means Joe gave a favor, right? Favor condition irrelevant, that means someone else gave the Coke, okay? And then no favor is simple to interpret. That's just Joe going away and coming back. If Joe just went away and came back, you notice that they didn't buy so many lottery tickets, right? 0.8 on average, right? If there was a favor, in other words, you did get Coke, then you're buying quite a bit. But here's the interesting thing. Based on so you remember, we have a rating of how pleasant Joe is, right? So in other words, at the end of the experiment, the subject rates whether Joe seemed like a likable, interesting person, right? But if you notice, it doesn't matter that Joe is pleasant or unpleasant. They're still buying lottery tickets. You see that? Because this rating is still pretty high. It's definitely higher than anything in the no favor group. But despite that, they're still buying 1.6. You see what I'm saying? So regardless of how likable Joe seemed to be, they still was buying a lot of lottery tickets. So that gives you evidence that the idea is that actually it's not the likability of Joe that's influencing it. It really is him giving you a gift. In other words, him giving you a gift was not the thing that was leading to likability. A lot of people didn't like him, actually. It seems creepy, I don't know, whatever. But they still bought a lot of lottery tickets. Right, so that's telling you that probably it really is the actual exchange of the gift. Right. So the stuff that we did anecdotally, now we actually have experimental basis. Because now it's a firm control. It's actually able to separate out somewhat likability as opposed to the reciprocity, which is actually the exchange of the gifts, right? So a lower panel is a little bit tricky, more tricky issue, but let me get back to it. So this is what I was just saying. I'll repeat it just so you guys can understand it better. Just looking at likability alone does not explain this data. What you have to look at is the reciprocity relationship, right? So you can actually explain this in terms of what the subject is thinking. So one way of explaining is the following, right? So first, let's look at the favor condition in which they're getting a gift from Joe. They're getting the Coke from Joe. What that could be happening is that the subject is justified for being compliant to buy lottery tickets even when they don't necessarily want to. I mean, not going to win this car. They have not much motive to buy this, right? They're just giving the money away almost. But they're justified for doing it because it's reciprocity. In other words, they can justify themselves spending that money, giving that money away because, oh wait, this poor person bought me Coke. Is reciprocity. There's no cognitive dissonance inside their mind that they need to solve. Now, let's look at the control condition. Control condition is different. Control condition, you're giving money to someone who you don't know, basically, right? Never gave you a gift, never received anything. So in that case, it must be the case. Why am I giving this person money? It must be the case that this person is likable. Do you guys see what I'm saying? So this is the kind of part I skipped a little bit over. But if you look at down here in the no favor condition, pleasant and unpleasant, when they're rating it, the Joe is unpleasant, they're giving much, this is a slightly different one. So this is based on just the liking rating upon the different conditions. So what this is saying is just that there's a big discrepancy between some people who think that Joe was pleasant and some people who think that were unpleasant. In the favor group, they mostly are about split even, right? So remember, this is the one I was saying is that despite whether they're rating them high or low, they're still buying the lottery tickets, right? So in this case, it's showing you the following. It's showing that most people, there's no difference between pleasant and unpleasant. Some people rate them high, some people rate them low. You see what I'm saying? Okay. And same thing with the irrelevant favor. But in the no favor, there's a discrepancy. Some people really like Joe, some people don't like him, Joe, as much. I hope that was not as confusing as it should be. But this number being different means some people like Joe a lot and some people didn't like Joe. Right? Only in the no favor condition. Why would that be? This person is like, didn't do anything. Why would you have some people like him a lot and don't like him a lot? And at the end, the group aggregate is that they're not buying a lot of lottery tickets. So one explanation is that for some people, they're attributing this to likability. In other words, they have to part the money somehow. They bought like one on average at least 0.9 lottery tickets, right? So it must be that person was somewhat likable. That's why I bought it. Because if you look at the breakdown of the data, the people who actually rated Joe as pleasant in the no favor group actually was the ones who bought more tickets. Right? You see what I'm saying? So it's kind of a contrast. Either it's because this person's likable or because this person gave me something, reciprocity. In either case, there's no dissonance in my head, how I think. Because if I actually end up buying a lottery ticket, that must be, Joe must have been likable, attractive in some way, if he didn't do any favors. What this also says is that this compliance, right, in which you're getting this normative, they're called normative pressure, because it's social pressure in order to get you to do something that you don't want to. Well, when this kind of strong normative social pressure is not there, that reciprocity relationship is not there, you never got a Coke, then likability affects compliance. Then how well you like somebody affects it. Right? So they're kind of grouping together two important concepts in social psychology. Okay, are you guys okay with this experiment? It's kind of interesting understanding of how reciprocity can happen. Okay, so I got a couple more, and then we're going to go into neuroscience. Take a look at some people kind of starting to try to tease out some of these relationships. Okay, this one is also very interesting because it probably won't happen in Japan as well. But so in this experiment, again, very simple. These people went to a beach. This is a work from Thomas Moriarty's lab. I think he's at Cornell. So what he does is he gets a confederate, so that's someone who's actually an experimenter, to go in there. They go to a beach, they put a blanket down, and literally like right next to somewhere, like they can see it very well, right, these subjects, right? They put a blanket down, they put initially it was a radio, but then when they repeated the experiment, it was like an iPad. The iPad that connected to the ones that the speaker is connected to the iPad. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Like the speaker plays directly from the iPad. Anyways, so they put that there, and then after a while he goes away, this person who did this, and then a different confederate, another experimenter, comes in and just takes the radio, like just steals it basically, just right in front of these other people's eyes. I mean, we're talking about like right here, like this person right here can see it, right? Actually, it would be interesting to look at how the different cultures react. Actually, I wonder how, I'm not prepared to say one way or the other how in Japan this experiment would happen. But in America, this is what happens, okay? So this is what I was saying. They went to New York Beach, they put a radio there, and then someone else steals it, right? So one thing, with the one group is just no contact, right? So you don't, this person just comes and goes, right? But they can see very well, right? They have the cameras, they can see the people who are next to them. The people recognize them, they know that exists, they know that the radio is there, etc., etc., right? So they can control for that, right? Only 4 out of the 20 people who are in separate experiments who are right next to them actually did anything to stop the theft. It means, wait, what are you doing? You know, that kind of thing. Okay. So some people, I guess most people, just nothing. They just poke it, that's it. For me, it's kind of surprising, but they can get that to happen. I mean, it's crowded, you know, but there's some uncertainty there with the crowdedness, so maybe that contributes. In the second group, that person who came in with the radio just asked very briefly, said, okay, you watch this real fast? Like, that's it. No social interaction, okay? No getting to know them, likability, that kind of thing, right? They just said that, and then they just go away. When you did that, 19 of the 20 people stopped the theft, right? I mean, this is why, you know, when you're in an airport, a lot of times, when I've had this experience, I literally don't know the person next to me. I never met this person in my life, but I have tons of stuff. I just, well, can you watch me for a few seconds? I go to the toilet, like on shin, right? I just like happy in the fact that my stuff is going to be fine, even though there's no locks, there's no, you know what I'm saying? Like, all the zippers are probably open, they can reach in and whatever they want, but it's this kind of commitment, okay? So the point of this experiment, sorry, I didn't say it well early, but the point of this experiment is that there's a commitment there by these other people that we're trusting here. So the person is committing to the idea that they're kind of there to watch over something, right? Even if it's just not much of a social influence, not much of a likability issue, nothing at all, just by the fact that somebody asks you, you know, look after it, boom, they're committed to looking after it. They have the same viewpoint in terms of how they recognize what's there, when these persons come and go, but because they're asked to do it, they're committed to doing it, right? So they almost always stop the theft. Okay. So here's another interesting thing, right? The last bit of piece here, right? What if that person who's asking you to look after stuff is, like, obviously obnoxious, right? So they did this by screaming babies, like, being, like, clearly obnoxious, like, putting gum next to your stuff, you know? Like, it was clearly obnoxious, like, loud, dirty. They actually did an experiment in which the personal hygiene was changed, so like there's this woman who didn't shave her armpits or something. No, I'm not serious. Like, they actually did this. And despite that, all she had to say was, can you look at this real fast? Boom. 19 out of 20, right? So in other words, even those dislikable, despicable people, as long as they say, look after my stuff, you're committed to looking after this stuff. And this is actually kind of good proof that this is also not likability, right? This is, you know, the previous experiment, they said, well, it really is reciprocity. This experiment, it really is the commitment. They're actually forming a commitment that says, wow, this is, you know, this is something I gave my word to, kind of, right? Even if you don't acknowledge it, you're kind of committed to doing this, right? It's very strong. So you guys should all be aware, kind of sometimes some of the commitments that you make that maybe you don't necessarily want to, right? Okay, so that's number 2. That's commitment. I have a good 20 minutes. It's okay. I will attempt to go into a little bit more detail. Okay, so this is the next experiment. I'm going to go a little bit faster on this one, but to skip to some of the neuroscience. But the next one is consistency. Now, similar to commitment, in this case, you're trying to make whatever you agreed on consistent throughout, right? So here's what the study is, right? So have you guys heard about this line judgment experiment? So it's initially pioneered by Solomon Asch. What they do is they give you 3 different lines and then 1 standard line, and they ask you which of the 3 lines is kind of the same length of the standard line, right? Sometimes they're longer or shorter, right? Based on whatever. They're seeing this on paper most of the time, right? As you can see here, the S, I hope you can agree. Sometimes it's hard to tell, but I hope you can agree S is the one that's closest to H, right? Okay, so, but this is, in different experiments, there are actually situations where they put A like here, and it still works. It's amazing, right? Okay, so anyway, so they give you that, and then they have a different setup in which there's a group, and everybody comes, and they go like, basically it's kind of a teacher kind of thing, and they go like, oh, let's see, what do you guys think here? I think A is the correct answer. You guys agree? A? Yeah? And then everybody in the room is like, yeah, A, let me see. Yeah, I think A is right. In that situation, most people, right, I mean, we're talking about like 70-80% of people, are going to say A is right. I mean, if, you know, I mean, this is actually slightly uncertain here. I know you guys are sitting in the back, you know. But even if I make those lines really different lengths, you can actually get this to happen. This is pretty amazing, social pressure, how strong it is. Now, this is the basic experiment, but they're going to do different things in this experiment to adapt this experiment to their own kind of questions, right? So let me see here. So Doyce and Girard have the following set of experiments. So now they have, first of all, it's kind of a separate phase of the experiment. So first, they ask the people to estimate the length of the lines in their own mind, right? So and they're basically getting them to, the idea is to get them to commit to some idea of what the correct answer is, okay? Before the kind of social dynamics comes in, right? Right. In the social dynamic class, also, they can either give a group or they just let themselves decide. Okay? I'm going to skip over a lot of the intricacies, but to get to the main point. So the main point is this. So they have three different groups. So one group is they're asked in when they're judging the initial trial in which they're judging the length in their own mind. So this is pre-experiment. They're actually doing that in public, face-to-face, and writing it on paper. I think it's A signed. That's the first group. And then after that, then the actual group comes and discuss which is the answer and then try to change their mind, basically, right? They're always trying to change their mind. Okay? So that's group one. Hopefully that's understood. Group two, they just, no social dynamics before the core experiment. They let them sit in their own room. They know that there are three other objects, so this is kind of a control, right, because they know how many people are there. But by themselves, they are putting down on this kind of erasable whiteboard, they're putting on the erasable whiteboard what they think the answer is before actually someone comes in and tries to change their mind. Okay? So they're committing on themselves privately. And actually, it is private because they can just erase the board and then nobody would know. Okay? The third group, again, the three subjects are isolated, but in this case, they know that they're competing with other groups. Actually, that's not the important part. The important part is they never write down anything. They just say, well, think about what you think the right answer is. Like, it's the same condition as two, except they don't write it down. It really is the same control. Okay, so the private but without writing anything down. So what do you guys, I'll let you guys think, what do you think is the one that's kind of most easy to change your mind? So remember, after this initial set, right, the next part of the experiment is basically the same. They're all, people come in as a group to try to change their mind. Basically, they go, oh, this is, it's A, it's not, you know, it's clearly not B or whatever, right? The question is what percentages do you get in each group? So in other words, what condition made it possible for each group to actually change their mind? What was the commitment and how were they consistent to that commitment, right? Depending on how they formed it. So this is why it's a consistent experiment and it's not a conformity experiment like in the Ash original study. Okay, so I'll let you guys think about it real fast. But here's the thing. The public commitment, the one where they say, I think this is the answer, I write it down on paper, I sign it, that one, you don't get conformity, right? So this is, least conformity. I didn't write this down. The most stringent on, they're least acceptable to conformity. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I wrote this down, sorry. Least acceptable conformity in group one. What that means is They're not willing to change what they decided initially. They're writing it down on paper. They publicly committed to it. The other people can see them do it. They're not going to change, regardless of the subsequent social pressure. The group in which they're not getting commitment, so in other words, they're just imagining what they think the right answer is, and then later on, they change their mind, that's the easiest one to change. I mean, they literally just like, okay, maybe that's not the right answer. Right, despite kind of thinking about it and figuring out, right? So I don't have time to go into some of the other details, but basically the idea is that there is two different types of social influence. One is the informational influence. What informational influence means is that when you're uncertain about the information, in this case the line, how long they are, what you do is kind of defer to others, right? Because you don't have the information. So you think whatever other people think could be correct, right? Now, that's different from normative social influence. Because normative social influence is not about the information. It's about fitting it in the group. So normative information is because you want to be liked. You want to be like the other people who are well-liked. So therefore, you're adapting your opinion based on that. So they actually are able to tease out those core differences between using group 2 and 3, right? So some of the details that I don't have time to talk about. Again, when you're in a group, you're very susceptible to the second part of it, which is the ability to kind of, you know, adapt your opinion based on liking things, right? So even without, they know that because even without the normative influence in group two, in which they're just by themselves deciding what the answer was, even there, they are still susceptible to subsequent changes to their opinion. Okay? The fact that you can get that, as opposed to the public case in which they're not changing, tells you that that just the information influence by itself was enough. Just the fact that they were uncertain about the information was enough to get them to have different opinions. Okay, it's a little bit tricky, but the main idea is that if you write it down and you put it on paper, like, you're not going to change. But in other cases, you can. So that's kind of an idea about commitment. Okay. So I'll go a little bit more quickly. I want to talk about this real fast because it's actually really important, especially I think in Japan as well. But actually, people have also looked at suicides, right, and suicide rates. So the next part is kind of correlation study, right? But what happens is they see that in America in the 70s, the newspaper stories on big suicide, like someone commits suicide, front page, that actually correlated with suicide rates. Amazing, right? And not only that, so they're calling this the Werther effect, which means like you're actually getting these suicide spikes whenever you're getting a big front page suicide story when it's highly publicized. But not only that, but the stories of kind of these big murders and kind of things that happen that's more than just suicide, that actually correlates with spikes of these like crashes, like big car crashes. They actually saw airplane crashes in the initial study. They actually correlates, right? So let me just show you the data. So here they're showing a number of commercial airline crashes and also non-commercial airline crashes and vehicle fatalities. And you can see when the story comes out, boom, in that kind of two-week window, you're getting these spikes that is statistically significant. It's not saying that this is the only reason, okay, but it's statistically significant that you're getting more, you know, fatalities that could be caused by suicide and suicides as well, right? Again, the way they look at this is that because this is social proof, you're actually looking to other people when deciding on your life-death situations. It's very amazing. Why? Because there's a couple of details, right? So one is the following. You can make some predictions. If the crashes really are indicative of these suicides, then they actually should be more deadly because they want to kill themselves as lethally as possible. They don't just want to maim themselves. And when you actually look at the data, and you can see that actually they are actually get more deadly crashes. So not only are there more crashes, but they are more deadly, meaning that they actually go in there and figure out, you know, I really have to do this in order to die, right? So that's consistent with this. There's another prediction where it seems that if you want to do this, you actually want to imitate people who are most similar to you, right? So if you're looking on your to your life in this situation, you probably want to look at someone who's more similar to you, which means if you're older, you look at older people, younger, you look at younger people. Look at the data, same thing. If you look at the stories of younger people dying, younger suicide, you get the younger people-specific driver crashes more. You look at the older people, again, it's consistent with the idea that not only are they dying more, but they're looking to their own types for social proof of how they should be behaving, right? I mean, this is scary, right? I mean, when I read about this, I was scared. you're looking at stuff that you might not even think matters at all, but statistically it matters, right? In fact, in America, they can actually look at boxing matches. So someone actually went in and look at boxing matches and look at who lost those boxing matches. And this is back in the days in the 70s, 80s, where like everybody watched the boxing matches. It's kind of a big deal, like Muhammad Ali kind of thing. But when they look at that and they look at who lost those matches, if someone who lost was white, you actually get increased rate of homicide perpetrated by young white gang members, basically, or people who are more likely to do homicide. When someone who lost was black, actually more black people committed crimes, homicides at that time. Very amazing, actually. It's all correlational, there's no proof, there's other factors involved, but just given that you see this correlation, it's already very scary, that social proof by itself may have an influence on how you're behaving, even in life and death, right? This is kind of the counter-argument for saying, well, it's probably important, when we prefer Coke or Pepsi, but at the end, it's not so important. You're going to buy one or the other. They're both pretty delicious. What's the big deal? This is the counter-argument that says it is a big deal, because people are actually deciding, at least partially, possibly, whether they're going to keep living or not based on big stories. It's a very amazing set of studies, in my opinion. Okay, I have 10 more minutes, so I'm going to skip over this a little bit, but this scarcity is very simple. Again, it's basically when you're saying, when you have a scarce number of resources, you tend to prefer more. So the basic of the experiment is just the following. When they give someone a jar of cookies to rate, again, to rate whether how delicious it is, how desirable it is as a product, when they put it in a jar of 10 versus a jar of 2, which one do you think is rated as more attractive and desirable and delicious, right? Without eating them, of course. The jar of 2, the one that they can get from the 2, because it's more scarce. What's more, the most desirable cookies, guess what it is? The most desirable cookie is the one where they give you a jar of 10, right before you ready to do the answering. The experiment comes in, actually it's this jar of 2, which is exactly the same, right? Because we have to give these other cookies to other experimental groups. That one is off the roof. That's even above the jar of 2. That's also above the one where they come in and they say, oh, my mistake, it's actually this jar of 2, not this jar of 10, right? Because in that case, they're actually, some other people are demanding it. It must be really scary. It must be hella good. So therefore, these cookies must be tremendous, right? So very subtle ways. Some of you might not have caught all the details, but very subtle way of you presenting the information, how you present the jar of 2, is going to influence how you rate them. So in this case, you actually create in the mind a scarcity that actually never existed. And by artificially creating this sense of scarcity, you're getting people to rate these cookies higher. Okay? Yeah, it's okay if you guys, have to, whatever. I'll try to leave some time later for you guys who have questions. But I'll finish so you guys have a story. Okay? Okay. So that's scarcity. I think that's pretty simple enough. It makes sense that it's important. This is the data. If you're interested, you can email me later or something like that. But basically, that's the main idea. Okay. So now I want to, in the remaining 7-8 minutes or so, maybe a little bit less time than that, because I want you to have some questions, time for answers, questions, is that I'll talk about a little bit about some neuroscience about how this thing goes. Now, neuroscience has not gone the way of the complete social psychology categorization of these tasks. It's just not possible. You can't scan people during this entire process. And when they're in the scanner, you have the control for a lot of different things. There are some studies actually recently on that, but I'm not going to talk about the very, very frontier stuff. But I'm going to tell you basically about one or two experiments that really seem to be important. So what happens is when you look at all the data together, what people find, and this is mostly from functional imaging, is they find that the posterior part of the MFC, this is the medial frontal cortex, I'll show you a picture first, tends to be the guy that's kind of the area that's attributing to the cognitive aspect of this kind of conformity and consistency story. And the more anterior part seems to be more the emotional processing, how you're liked, you know. The kind of, actually this discrepancy is actually what I said a little bit before about the informational influence, right, versus the normative influence. Seems to be that the anterior part is more the anterior of the normative influence. Posterior part, a little bit more informational in terms of what you do in terms of uncertainty. There's also another part called the orbital MFC. That's a little bit different area. I'm not going to actually talk about much today because I don't have time, but that's talking more about updating and figuring out rewards and punishments and stuff like that. Okay. So, all right. So this is what the brain regions look like. The anterior part of the MFC is that one in the back. A lot of people call it the anterior cingulate. Basically, it's the anterior cingulate. The posterior part is more dorsal. And again, that's more of a cognitive area. So I'll go in and I'm not going to talk about the posterior and the orbital part so much today, although there's a lot of studies on that. For example, there's studies looking at intention and behavior. So what they do is they ask people to categorize different animals and things like that. And in that, doing that, they give you a distractor trial where they're distracting them. But it looks like this area is still active whenever you have the intention to keep going despite those distractions. Okay? So that's the posterior rostral MFC. I don't have time to talk about the orbital frontal again, but again, that's more of an updating area. They know because they actually did experiments where they look at regret. For example, there's like two different ways they can gamble. They chose to gamble one way. When they look at how the other way could have been, so if they have access to the stuff that they don't actually chose to gamble on, activation of orbital frontal. Okay. So anyway, that's a different area. But the area I want to focus on, I guess I can go as long as I want now, because it doesn't matter. Hopefully it's interesting to you anyways. It's 26. Anyways, probably another 5-10 minutes only anyways. It's the anterior rostral MFC, or really just very close to kind of the anterior cingulate, right? It's very similar categorization. So that area appears to be very important for perception of the self, self-knowledge, and also what I'm going to talk about, which is kind of the main experiment I will talk about in this part, is called mentalizing, which means imagining what other people are thinking about. So that's very important because if you look at all the previous psychology data, remember that I told you about, a lot of it is just figuring out, imagining what other people are thinking, right? Oh, other people are thinking that this line is shorter, must be shorter. Other people think that this cookie is good, this cookie must be good. So most of it really comes down to this core concept. So if we understand this, it's kind of a straight road to get into those other types of experiments. Okay, so in the self-knowledge literature, a lot of experiments, basically they look at trait words. So basically they present you with certain words and ask you which one you think identifies with you. When they find one that really does identify, they know because subsequently they gave them a rating, they actually see increased activation of this anterior MFC. Okay, so that's the self-knowledge. Same idea with the personal perception. When they are asked to think about attributes of yourself versus a friend, there's also an experiment in which they looked at self versus George Bush, somebody who you just know but you aren't acquainted with. Again, you have similar sorts of anterior rostral MFC activation, right? When you get to the core aspects of actually thinking about those differences. And this is not the core experiment, but this is similar, as opposed to the self-perception and self-knowledge, is to look about mentalization. So mentalization can be identified looking at this cartoon on the left here, right? So in the cartoon on the left, you appreciate the joke only if you're able to mentalize the fact that this person is fishing and is unaware of his fish being stolen. You see what I'm saying? And these other aspects, there's still some stuff going there, but there's a swimming, there's no action. You don't have to know that this person is, it's not funny, this picture. This part is funny because of this person being unaware. Right? So that's mentalization. That requires a certain type of skill. When you look at a well-controlled study of that, you can see activation mostly in this anterior area of the MFC. This is the anterior MFC right here. In the remaining time that I have, I want to give basically one study, right? Because it's kind of a very important classic study in the early 2000s, and that tells you, kind of gets us to the point of at least figuring out where this kind of type of process could be happening. It doesn't get us to explanation in terms of cause and effect and things like that just yet, but I think neuroscience is getting to the point where socially driven processes is actually now being starting to be investigated in a lot more details, for example, with imaging. Okay, so this is the following experiment. I'm actually doing the Graze's. I don't have time to go over the others. So the Graze experiment, they're doing the following. In the Graze experiment, what they do is they actually show videos of people lifting boxes, right? So here, let me just show you this first, right? I don't have the movie, but you have to kind of look at it and imagine it. So most of the time, they're lifting the box. Actually, the best to probably concentrate on the lower one. Most of the time, what they do is they lift the box, and then they put it down or move it, right? Now, some of the times, that person who's acting in this video is asked to fake it so that the box is heavier than it really is. Right? For example, if this is heavy, I can demonstrate right here, right? If this is heavy, I can just go, they're actually pretty good at it. If the actor is really good, it's actually pretty difficult for the subject to figure out. So it's something like a 60-40 kind of presentation, percent correct, whether they can actually figure out. The actor can also fake like it's lighter. Oh, this is nothing. That kind of thing. With the box, it's a lot easier with the microphone. Right? Very subtle, right? You notice this is very subtle detail. It's actually somewhat difficult for them to pick it up. But this is the thing that they're going to look at in terms of the rates of activation in the brain where this is happening. Okay? So what's happening when you're doing this, right? So they go in and they do the lifting of the box. Now, when the person in the video is actually trying to deceive the observer, right? So there's different things. So the video person may not necessarily have to want to deceive them. So in other words, the experimenters don't always tell the person in the video to really deceive them. And in the subsequent experiment, they don't tell the people who are observing the video that they are being actually actively deceived. In that case, it's just false information. They're just not aware of how heavy the box is. So there's a difference between being deceived and figuring out whether you're just not right about the information. Okay? It turns out you have differential activation of different areas based on those. So let me actually just skip to kind of the detail. Okay. So first of all, it's not easy to detect. Everybody has his own bias. So people are using nonverbal cues when they're doing this, right? Again, the actors are told to pretend like the box is a different weight in order to have these videos where minute details can be read out. They can actually make the judgment, so afterwards, on an observer, to see whether there was or was not an intent to deceive, right? The way they calculate this is they look at kind of a sensitivity in that, you know, I don't have time to go over to the exact details of how they're doing this, but basically they're looking at, they're summing up the fake correct trials. In other words, the guys faked it, but actually it was actually correctly interpreted that they faked it. They're adding it up to the real incorrect trials. They actually did it for real, but it was incorrectly interpreted as being fake. And they subtract, you know, the corners of those. Basically, it's an index for calculating how aligned they are, how sensitive they are to the deception, basically. Whether they are being deceived or they're not being deceived.
Okay.
This is the core experiment. When they actually look at the imaging, what happens is they see above, you know, contrast, there's activity in the MFC, the amygdala and the superior temporal sulcus when the action is thought to have deceptive intent. In other words, it looks like that person was faking it and wasn't right. Right? So these are the activations they're looking at. This is just by time. So over time, how these guys are looking, you notice that the fake correct guys are highest, right? Because that's kind of the key one, right? That's the one that, you know, this guy's faking it. I know this guy's faking it, right? And is correctly interpreting as that guy's faking it. Okay. There's actually a little bit of detail here because you have to actually isolate the idea that it's an intent to deceive as opposed to having a false belief. And the way they do that is just basically based on what they tell the second group. What they tell the second group different things about what the actor was actually doing. Okay. So the way they do that is in this experiment, they said, okay, somebody was deceiving you. You try to figure out, basically. On the previous experiment, they just said, well, they just didn't know what was heavier or lighter. So in other words, they don't go into the detail about, oh, this guy was actually faking it or whatever. They just said, well, we don't know. Why don't you try to figure it out, right? When you contrast those conditions, now you're able to separate having false belief from the actual intent to deceive, right? Intent to see being the actor actually was acting differently. In both cases, they are actually acting differently, but in one case, they don't believe that was intent to deceive. It was just their own false belief. Okay. When you actually look at those contrasts, now only the anterior rostral MFC and the amygdala has net activation. Okay. In the contrast. Meaning only those areas are specifically above and beyond active in the intent to deceive case, beyond just false belief. Okay, so this is kind of the data that look like. So remember, these are the areas that are active overall, right? But in these guys, you don't have a difference between the false belief and the deceptive intent. But in the anterior MFC and the amygdala, the via amygdala actually turns out to be slightly above normal also. It's just not statistically significant. It's just trending there. But you can see there that you have actual net activation, meaning that those are the areas that they believe it's actually kind of coding or at least involved with actual figuring out false belief, false intent, actually. Okay, deceptive intent. Okay, not just false belief. Okay, so this is kind of the kind of studies that have been going on. A lot of neuroimaging and also a lot of ERP, event-related potentials, looking at how the brain activity is changing. Again, these experiments are difficult because in psychology, it's still difficult to control for everything. And when you do, you have to do the scanning. You know, it's not clear how much you can learn beyond and above just from the scanning. So that's why there's actually a lot of new research that I didn't put on the slide, but there's a lot of new research, for example, from a group from Thema Amodio and others in Chicago, and also NYU, Columbia, those guys. They're looking at basically this new idea of a social neuroscience, which brings about different aspects, different ways of looking at this from a network perspective, from a computational perspective, from a more molecular area, also to try to dissect these questions about social dynamics and observation and figuring out what are the key components for actually affecting human behavior. It's a really hot topic. I'm actually The reason I talk about it is just because I personally also done some functional imaging stuff with motor control stuff when I was undergrad at Berkeley, and also just been keeping up with the literature, so I just wanted to kind of share this area with you and hope that you're getting something out of it. And in the future, I mean, I think this is kind of one of those areas in neuroscience that's really trending. So I feel like knowing about this kind of thing and trying to figure out ways to tease out the very more complex nature of these processes, right? I mean, these are not just optogenetic identification and then inhibitor or activated circuit and boom, you get reward or punishment, that kind of thing. It's not so simple. There's stuff about mentalization. You have to figure out how groups interact. You have to figure out how you're keeping track of other information, and then you have a small subtle change and that all changes. So it's very more difficult part of neuroscience, but I think this is the time, the next 10, 20 years, where people are actually going to start, you know, because stuff like optogenetics and recordings, they are getting to the point where people are understanding things fairly well, that now you can understand more complicated things like these social dynamics. And I think, I mean, especially in Japan, I think it's interesting to know the social dynamics. It's a very complicated structure. I think it's probably more complicated in America in many ways. So in summary, we're influenced by a lot of social processes that a lot of time are not conscious to us. Some of these processes include reciprocity, likability, commitment. So you take up something and then you just keep on it. I didn't talk about authority. That's like the classic Stanley Milgram experiment where that's discussed. And social proof, and actually that affects our behavior. So I'll show you a little bit about some of the neural mechanisms of how social influence could be happening. And in case in point, I showed you a specific example in which involving mentalizing action, so figuring out what other people are thinking while they're doing something, and you're getting specific activation in different parts of the brain that could be responsible for this process. And in the future, being able to actually manipulate these areas, for example, or that might not be easier, manipulating these areas or figure out ways to kind of do correlation studies with bigger groups, you know, that kind of computational effort might be fruitful to figure out how more of these complex dynamics and how we operate in this very social world. So thank you very much. I'm sorry that I didn't